This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions, online at www.bgov.com, and of course on the air right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. This week, we're reviewing the interesting story that is always lobbying returns, results, second quarter numbers are back. BGov data guru Dr. Peter Brusseau and Bloomberg Industries analyst Melissa Avstray will be here shortly to give us the tale of the tape. Who's spending the most? We'll figure that out in just a little while. But first, we'll begin the program with a discussion of bipartisan legislation in both chambers of Congress that would help us track medication from the manufacturer to you. That's right. Tap yourself on the shoulder. Do you get a prescription? We'll know that you got that prescription and from whence it came, whether it was illegal or not. With more, here's Bloomberg government analyst Brian Rye. Hey, Brian.
Alan, how are you?
I'm doing well. Does this scare you at all? Big brother-ish?
There's an element of that. I think the type of legislation that they're contemplating and, frankly, that will probably get passed won't be to that specific of a level, though the FDA probably would want that specific of a level.
I would imagine they would.
I think what we're going to talk about is, you know, every bottle or vial of medicine, and this is the goal of both the Senate and the House versions, would have a either a barcode or some sort of identifier on that package. At issue is whether it's going to be a unique identifier for each and every bottle, which is, again, what the FDA would want, mm-hmm. or whether sort of every manufacturing lot coming out of a manufacturer, which could be thousands of bottles or units, would have the same identifier on it, sort of unit level or lot level tracing.
And that's the basic difference between the Senate and House versions?
Well, both the Senate and the House versions start with lot level, and they're pretty similar.
And one evolves.
And one evolves a lot more quickly and more forcefully. The Senate is a bit stricter, saying within 10 years of that bill were it to pass, a unit level system shall go into effect. You know, that magical word in Washington, shall. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Whereas the House version gives the FDA and the industry a bit more leeway, telling the FDA to issue a proposed regulation, I believe in 2027, but nothing about final regulation, certainly nothing about implementation.
So this is really nothing new. State of California has kind of been doing this already.
So, you know, when we talk about bipartisan legislation with this Congress, that's almost an oxymoron because these guys can't figure out what to order on a pizza, you know, for lunch. There has to be some sort of external force bringing them to the table. And sure. As you mentioned, in this case, there is one. And that's a California legislation that will enact very strict lot level track and trace provisions in, I believe, beginning of 2015,
right.
Unless it's superseded by federal regulation. Now, if you're Pfizer, Merck, or a large wholesaler, you know, when you have an initial shipment of drugs that you either make or distributing, you don't really know if it's going to wind up in California or North Carolina or Florida or where have you. So if California, the most populous state in the union, enacts this legislation, you have to act as if a national standard's in effect anyway. And so that's the push where I think the drug makers and wholesalers are sort of behind this. The guys that I think would sort of not want this to happen are at the tail end of the chain, those smaller community pharmacies.
I was going to bring that up. You know, this lends itself to a lot of happiness and a lot of sadness at the same time.
You know, it is, you know, especially for those smaller community pharmacies outside California,
right.
Who wouldn't have to deal with that, you know, that state's regulation. You know, this is going to entail a lot of money having to be spent to upgrade infrastructure and just labor hours to not only track things as they come in the door, but then if there is a problem, a drug recall or something's gone wrong, people are going to be knocking on your door saying, all right, can you give me the transaction history? And you're going to have to be able to produce that on demand. And again, whether it's lot level or the much more draconian unit level, that's a lot of record keeping that you have to do.
You know, I think I'm a fan of the, as big brother as it sounds, I'm a fan of the unit level tracking, merely because you look at an elderly population. You've not necessarily got people who are paying as close attention to their medications. I mean, let's face it, Americans, people in general don't pay as close attention to their medications as they should and don't take them as they should, historically speaking. So, you've got an elderly population who may not necessarily understand what's happening. Their lot of medication, their blood pressure medication, has been recalled for whatever reason. Are they going to check it? Not necessarily. And if you can go into a pharmacy and pull out a list of everybody who received that particular pill from that lot, I think it's far more powerful.
I think the FDA would hire you as a spokesman today, because that's essentially their position, is that if you want to be able to prevent these things from happening in the first place, instead of just merely being able to reconstruct something sure. after the fact and after something has unfortunately gone wrong, you almost need the unit level. And now, you know, again, the pharmacies and some other stakeholders would argue that maybe that fear is overblown, but whether it's counterfeit drugs or something, you know, not even as nefarious, simply maybe a drug that requires special handling or needs to be cooled when it's shipped, just to be able to make sure that it has been, you know, from point A to point B to point C and then ultimately to you, I think helps to prevent some of these things from happening. But again, something this size on a national level has never really been attempted. And so there are some concerns about, are the technologies even mature enough? And certainly right. there's going to be an opportunity for supply chain management, either consulting or technology firms, to step in, because a lot of these companies certainly don't have the wherewithal or the knowledge to do it in-house.
Lots of areas of opportunity for someone to step in and actually make things happen. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where my guest right now is Brian Rye, Bloomberg Government Analyst, who's recently written Track and Trace, bipartisan bills in the House and Senate seek to improve the security of the drug supply chain. We're talking about two different pieces of legislation, Senate 959 and H.R. 1919, which basically address the same topic, and that is, how are we going to manage our drug infrastructure supply chain, so to speak? Talking about the state of California, which has already put in place, in the future, we'll be launching soon, the ability to track it to the lot level. And I'm arguing, along with the FDA, look at me, see my hat? It actually says FDA. A is for Alan. And we're talking about how we could possibly implement this on a nationwide level, because not only is it going to make drug manufacturers very happy, because they're not making an exception for the state of California, but it's going to make the FDA happy as well. You mentioned counterfeiting just a minute ago. My question is, how would this, or could this, quell the counterfeit drug trade? Looking at a chart here that you've included in the analysis, counterfeiters target drug makers. Out of the consumer safety and critical technologies classification within the government, 68% pharmaceuticals and personal care. I wonder what the personal care is, by the way. Pharmaceuticals and personal care. Out of that pie, 68% is what is counterfeited.
That's a lot. And what this would potentially do is put the onus on everyone in the supply chain. And again, not only would each package have an individual, some sort of label on it to help identify it, but the law would require, say, a pharmacy or wholesaler, if you receive a package, you have to verify, where did this come from? And if you can't verify that, you can't accept it.
Right.
And so the hope is that this sort of practice would prevent, again, drugs that had either exited the normal supply chain and then reentered, and right. we don't know what happened in that, or simply drugs that are counterfeit, you know, from entering the supply chain and then getting to American citizens.
Any other organizations that have skin in the game aside from drug makers, the FDA, so to speak? Anybody else that's curious about making this happen?
I think, you know, everybody, even logistics providers, people who ship these drugs, right. you know, because again, some of these have special handling, and they're going to be held to the same level of accountability to make sure that if a drug, again, needs to be on dry ice, for example, that it is during that time. So they're not going to be exempt. But I think, again, a lot of the folks who deal with supply chain management, irrespective of the industry, are going to be very interested in this, because this is something that, again, has never been attempted on a national level, with millions of products, being targeted out of the blue, just like that. And so I think there's going to be an opportunity for either entrepreneurs or folks to maybe take a look at these issues and see what they can do.
Obviously, the big box pharmacies are going to be fine. Could this be the death of the small mom and pop pharmacy?
You
see them come and go all the time, but this, now we're talking about a lot of money to make this happen.
It is. Now, you know, I think that concern's been expressed, and I think the folks on Capitol Hill have learned, have listened a little bit. You know, there are provisions in both the Senate and the House versions for the FDA to look at, you know, what would happen if you exempted smaller pharmacies, say less than 25 employees, from some of these requirements. But there's not a mandate that they have to do so. They're just supposed to see what happens. You know, what if you're a pharmacy with 27 employees? You know, yeah. you just fire two and meet that. So there's a lot of things that are going to have to be worked out, and both bills call for a series of workshops and pilot projects. And so this thing will evolve over the course, if it is passed, will, you know, probably evolve over the course of the next decade or so.
I'm looking at Mayberry, where you've got the grocer, who's the pharmacist, and possibly the hairstylist as well.
Floyd the barber.
Floyd, that's the right. We'll have to see what happens. What's next along this fight?
Well, so the timing is such that the House has already passed its version. Mm-hmm. They passed it in June, sent it to the Senate. The Senate did sort of an interesting thing. The HELP committee, approve this version, but then combined it with a separate bill dealing with compounding pharmacies, which were at the heart of the meningitis outbreak last fall. Mm-hmm. Somewhat similar, but separate legislation. They combined that. The Senate as a whole has yet to take up that combined bill, S-959. That complicates things a little bit in terms of the timing, because, again, the House version, which has already passed, solely deals with track and trace, has nothing to do with compounding pharmacy. The House is just beginning to look at a compounding pharmacy bill. So we'll see what happens. I do expect the Senate to pass their version, and then whether they get together in a formal conference or not, I think something does get done again before that January 1st, 2015 deadline, when California's law goes into effect, unless a federal law supersedes it.
Compounding pharmacy being one that would receive multiple drugs that would have to be verified and then merge it into something
else?
So
a compounding pharmacy is something, and lots of pharmacies, community pharmacies, have the ability to do this and are licensed to do this, mm-hmm. where maybe it's a standard FDA approved drug, but if it's intended for, say, a child, you'd like to add a cherry or a grape flavor for that, or even you, Alan, you might like that.
Yeah, I'm a fan of cherry.
You know, that you know, there are, you don't have to go through the new process of getting formal FDA approval for a new drug to do that. What's happened is, and what was at the heart of last fall's unfortunate outbreak, is that a large organization wasn't doing this in response to a single prescription, but was just mass producing a lot of these and then selling them wherever they could. And I think that some of the folks in Congress have said, wait a minute, you know, that's a separate class. That's not sort of the spirit of the rule there. And so the Senate would like to create a new class called compounding manufacturers that would be under the auspices of the FDA. Republicans aren't so sure. They think that, you know, the issue last fall was existing adequate laws at the state and federal level simply weren't enforced. And so writing new laws that may not be enforced wouldn't solve that problem. So that's going to be kind of an issue that has to be worked out. And again, attaching that to the relatively straightforward track and trace provisions may delay, how soon they can get to a final agreement on this.
Brian, thank you so much. Tracking, Track and Trace, bipartisan bill in the House and Senate, seeks to improve the security of the drug supply chain. I know you're going to keep us abreast of what's going on with this.
Look forward to it.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where my guests are Melissa Avstray and Dr. Peter Brusso. They are the data gurus. Hello. How are you?
Good.
How are you, Alan?
I'm doing well. It's about that time where we start discussing again lobbying results. And the second quarter numbers are in. Melissa, I got to ask you, lobbying, a lot of it happens up and down K Street. There's firms all over. People leave the Hill, end up on K Street. It's a revolving door. So what's happening over there right now?
So things are looking up. Peter and I were here, I guess it was March or April, to talk about the first quarter filings, and things were not looking so good. Mm-hmm. Cassidy, one of the DC powerhouses in the first quarter, was down about 25%. But good news, they're down only 2%.
Ding, 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 second quarter. Talking about being down is only, I guess that's good.
I mean, be a little better than 25, right?
Good point.
And some of the other big firms, Study Revenue, Patton Boggs is about the same. Akin Gump saw about a 5% increase. So things are looking up. Around 1,000 new clients were registered in the second quarter. Yeah, compared to 600 in the first quarter. So hopefully we'll have even better things to report in a few months from now.
Earlier this year, the big topic of conversation was sequestration, the automatic spending cuts that went into effect in March. Has that impacted or played a role in this at all?
It's kind of unclear. So we took a look at the defense prime contractors, so the General Dynamics, Boeing, Lockheed. A little inconsistent. Boeing and Lockheed spent slightly more in the second quarter than they did in the first quarter. Northrop, though, dropped 39% in spending on lobbying, while General Dynamics increased by 35%. So it's kind of a little all over the place. We know Northrop does a lot of work on the F-35, which is Lockheed's biggest defense program, and that appears relatively protected. General Dynamics, this is a good indicator of why they increased. They just had a recent earnings call talking about the need for congressional support for their Abrams tank modernization. So you know, that could be one of the reasons why they threw a lot of money into lobbying in, in the second quarter as Congress was preparing the defense spending bills.
It's interesting, and that kind of rings true with the way I've viewed sequestration thus far. A whole lot of talk about what appears to be, I won't say nothing, because I know it's impacting a lot of people's lives at this point.
Sure.
You know, furlough Fridays at the White House, and people, I personally know of people who have lost their jobs as a result of sequestration because they're no longer on the contracts. But this kind of rings to the fact that, well, defense money is still being spent.
Yeah, so for the defense primes, you know, the big ones, it doesn't seem that there was a lot of impact, or maybe less than they expected, from sequestration. You know, they have other, you know, markets to sell their wares to. You know, international sales, for example, can help bridge the gap if U.S. sales slide. But we did see some, like, companies.
And there's been a lot of that. There has been a lot of overseas market shopping, for sure.
For sure. And companies that, like, supply the spare parts to the defense weapon makers, I think those are the ones that are feeling the pinch right now due to sequestration, because the big contracts are being delayed to kind of see how everything shakes out. So I think the smaller companies are the ones that are actually feeling the sequestration pinch.
All right, let's talk big spenders, money. I want to know who's spending
big
the most.
Big spenders. Comcast was one of the top spenders in the second quarter. There was a lot of – we saw a lot of lobbying registrations, lobbying disclosures on this retransmission issue. I'm not sure how familiar are with that. It kind of pits the cable providers against the broadcasters.
The networks, the quote-unquote traditional networks. So
exactly. So we saw companies like Comcast, Verizon, DirecTV, Starz all citing this retransmission issue in their quarterly filing. So that was one of the big ones in the second quarter.
That could end up biting them in the rear end, couldn't it? You know, they go through with this and they pass the savings, in air quotes, on to the consumer.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and obviously, you know, they're looking for either the regulators or for Congress to kind of mediate, you know, their disputes on, you know, who pays what fees to air what shows.
This is a big topic of conversation in New York right now as we bring Dr. Peter Brusso into the conversation. You know, Time Warner right now is in a heated battle with CBS.
And I was just seeing that they just extended the deadline until the end of this week to try and negotiate how those deals will work out.
Yeah.
It'd be kind of weird not to be able to see David Letterman in New York City when he's just broadcasting right from Broadway.
Yeah. I saw interesting graphics on Bloomberg TV with behind bars. You know, here, this is where your CBS programming would be, but unfortunately, we can't come to an agreement. So Channel 2 is bye-bye in New York.
Yes.
We'll have to see what happens. Peter, what? There's lots of other stuff going on. Get us up to speed.
Sure. And everyone else might be on summer vacation, but here in D.C., everyone is still going full throttle. We've seen some huge stuff going on with the healthcare law lately going on. Bloomberg government is, of course, doing a great job tracking the impacts of the Affordable Care Act. But we're seeing that the American Hospital Association, 24 disclosed lobbyists working on this issue. They've spent $4.45 million in the past quarter. That's a ton of money and a ton of resources. We also see the American Medical Association. They spend only a little less than that. They spend about $4.12 million, and they have probably around 20 or so lobbyists working on this healthcare issue.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, how much of this has to do with the employee mandate, various other elements of the Affordable Care Act?
A lot of it has to do with Medicare reimbursement. There's a lot of concerns about how much money doctors would be getting paid for certain procedures. There's also bigger issues related to what's covered under the insurance plan, what's not covered under the insurance plan, and other issues related to patient care.
I was reading just recently in a newspaper about how healthcare providers are now tailoring the way they handle people with Medicaid and Medicare to provide them fewer services because of the fact that their payments aren't as high.
Exactly. And the goal for most of these trade associations is, you know, they are committed to patient quality, but also trying to maximize the amount of revenue that they have for their hospitals, their healthcare facilities, as well as watching out for the doctors, nurses, and other physicians working in the hospitals.
Are we at the point now where you go online to try to find a physician and it says, if you are this or that, we don't take you?
Well, it's been happening for several years now, and I think this is exacerbating the issue.
Yeah. Are there any other players that are maybe new to this?
So one of the weird kind of new players to this is a group called the Public Access to Sunscreens Coalition, or the PASS Coalition. And as you know, the Federal Drug Administration has to review all kind of over-the-counter medications. Mm-hmm. And they've set up a process to sort of do this probably about 10 or 11 years ago. In that time, the sunscreen industry is trying to push forward for certain new chemicals to be able to use in their processes. You know, more effective, reduced costs, easy to produce.
Sure.
And in the past 11 years, they haven't approved any of them. And some of these chemicals, my dad's a science teacher, and I wish he was here to help pronounce some of these. But we have stuff like enzachyme or isotretinoin or emsicol. And these have been sitting at the FDA waiting for approval for the past 11 years. And so the Sunscreen Coalition wants to be able to get through, have rapid approval on that, and have a more transparent process. So we've been adding those to the sunscreens to pass on to consumers. So to give you an idea of how much they're pushing behind this, in the first quarter they spent $50,000. This past quarter they spent $150,000 pushing for this issue. Because, you know, if there's a time to have sunscreen, it's in the summer.
Time out. These chemicals have been sitting around the FDA since the 70s, and they're still debating about whether they're going to put these in there.
And you want to rub them on your skin.
I know, and I'm going to rub this stuff on my skin. Bring it on.
To clarify, the chemicals we've been using in our sunscreen date back to the 70s.
Okay, all right.
These have only been sitting around for a decade or more.
Okay, all
right. And some of them, you know, are a little bit more recent, but a lot of these they've been trying to push for, and there's an issue about transparency in FDA tests because as Food and Drug Administrations go, the United States is a very conservative process before it goes to market, which, you know, it's good for the consumer. On the other hand, it also delays, you know, the ability of companies to get stuff out there for them to use in their products.
Yeah. Melissa, here, I've got some isotriezanol. Come on, I'm going to put some of this before we go.
Thank you, Alan. I misplaced my isotriezanol.
Okay, no problem, no problem. It's a little dusty, but that's okay.
We also have some other new groups getting there, too.
Just saying.
The Academy of the Doctors of Audiology, they just hired Prime Policy Group to work on Medicare reimbursement. So when you're thinking particularly about people who have to have hearing aids and have linguistic issues with their hearing system, then they need that taken care of. And Medicare is, again, having issues with how they reimburse for that. We've also seen the American Physical Therapy Association hiring Powers, Powell, Sutter, and Verville to also lobby that kind of issue. So healthcare has been a huge boon to the lobbying industry right now.
All right. So healthcare aside, let's shift gears slightly and move over to education. Talked about your dad being a science teacher.
Summer vacations coming to an end.
What's going on there?
So one of the issues we've seen with incarcerations, it's not just defense issues. We're also seeing a lot of issues related to education taking a hit. And so we're seeing a lot of lobbying on earlier childhood education. 0-3, which is a nonprofit that works to advocate for, you know, early education for all people. They just hired Mercury, Clark, and Weinstock to lobby on budget issues. And we also wound up seeing Accelerator Learning, who also operates Head Start Centers, lobbying on similar issues.
I'm sure, because No Child Left Behind is going to be up for reauthorization as well. They probably have a dog in that fight.
Absolutely, they want to increase the funding that they have for themselves as centers operate, early childhood centers, as well as people who teach children. We've also seen, you know, for those going back to, you know, elementary school and high school, the American Federation of Teachers have started to lobby a tremendous amount of money. Working on the Marketplace Fairness Act of 2013, as well as the National Labor Board nominations, making sure that they have people who are, you know, friendly to their interest on there. We've also seen Pearson Education, so for all the school kids out there listening, those are the guys that design a lot of the standardized tests the schools use to make sure that, you know, they continue to use, you know, their tests, and that, you know, they have some standardized ways of measuring student success.
His name is Dr. Peter Brusso. Her name is Melissa Abstract. Melissa, you're starting to rash there from that stuff, that isotriconol, whatever. We're going to put that away for now. But anyway.
It's better than getting a sunburn.
Good point. No need sun for this. Right. Second quarter lobbying results. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thanks
for having us.
And with that, we put the wraps on yet another edition of Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. Follow us on Twitter at BGov. Follow me on Twitter at Alan L. Scott. Bloomberg Government has a television program. It's called Capital Gains, seen weekly immediately following Face the Nation on WUSA 9, Sundays at 11:30. Hosted by Bloomberg Television's Peter Cook, Capital Gains, Sundays at 11:30. I'll be back next Thursday at 11 with plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.